This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm producer Faye Adabita. You're joining us for the second part of our three-part episode with organizational psychologist and best-selling author Adam Grant. If you haven't heard part one, just jump back an episode and get up to speed. Adam was live on stage for our Intelligence Squared event at London's Cadogan Hall recently to talk about his latest book, Hidden Potential, written to help us all unlock that next level of achievement. He was joined on stage by another best-selling author, the economic journalist and FT columnist, Tim Harford. Tim's latest book is How to Make the World Add Up. If you're an Intelligence Squared member, we've got something extra for you. Head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to gain access to our exclusive members-only part three of the discussion, where Adam and Tim took many more audience questions and the conversation really went to some explorative places. Or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Now let's rejoin Tim Harford and Adam Grant in conversation. We come back with Tim getting into the deep end of organizational psychology.
So on the subject of what psychologists can teach us, and stepping away from the book for a moment, because we don't want to cover everything in the book, because you all want to buy the book, right? Because it's fantastic. Can we talk about the state of organizational psychology and sometimes called the replication crisis, various scandals, which we won't go into, it's all just a bit too painful, but just this general feeling that Daniel Kahneman, I think, the great Nobel Prize winning psychologist, put it quite well recently. He said, 10 years ago, when I read a surprising finding that was backed by the data, seemed to be backed by the data, I'd believe it. And now when I read a surprising finding that seems to be backed by the data, my instinct is not to believe it. Because there have been some credible allegations of out and out fraud, but also just a lot of pretty sloppy research, a lot of stuff that turned out not to stand up. So what is your feeling about this field that you're in the middle of now?
So my job is not to have feelings about the field, it's to follow the evidence. And I think there are a couple of things that I've learned from the evidence. The first one is, look, science evolves and our methods should get rigorous over time. So, you know, a bunch of my early studies were done with smaller samples than I would use today. And part of that was a problem of access, and part of that was some flawed assumptions about statistical power that hadn't been, sort of made as transparent and clear as they are now. And so I think this is science progressing, is the first thing I would say. Second thing I would say is, I think that psychologists have taken the brunt of this when all kinds of fields are struggling with replication. There's a team led by Brian Nozick that famously, they tried to replicate over 200 papers in psychology and they found about half of the findings replicated. Well, we have to ask a question about what is the ideal replication rate? I don't expect every finding to replicate. Sometimes you have different people in your studies. Sometimes changes over time or across cultures or contexts really matter. And sometimes you happen to get support for something that's relatively rare and the outlier effect was there, and then you run a larger version of the study and it wasn't. And we don't want 100% replication rate because then we're not learning, we're not testing surprising ideas ever. Yeah. We're just confirming our intuition. So Brian's team recently, they did replications in cancer biology research and found failed replications over 40%. And so even the hard sciences have this problem, and there are all kinds of reasons why, you know, human bodies would respond differently to different drugs at different times. So I think we need to temper our expectations of science. We want science to get better, but I think what we want to know is that probabilistically, when you do a series of studies, that's more likely to approximate the truth than whatever your intuition is. Yeah. And I guess the other thing I would say about this is, I had a debate with Danny Kahneman about this. We did a Rethinking podcast a couple of years ago, and I was troubled by his statement that he doesn't believe a counterintuitive finding. Danny introduced us in part to confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Right? The problem that we all like to support the hypotheses we believe and reject the ones that don't match our assumptions and motivations. And so if you're gonna then knee-jerk reject a hypothesis because it doesn't sound true to you, you're being a bad scientist. And you know, you don't wanna have that debate with a Nobel laureate because you're not gonna win. And Danny convinced me that my thinking about this was incomplete and that there's a difference between what I've now come to think of as extremely counterintuitive findings and non-intuitive findings. I think there are a lot of cute findings in psychology where there's like a tiny thing you do and then it changes your life. Like, we should be skeptical about that. That is counterintuitive. It's the opposite of what is likely to be true. Non-intuitive is what, much more of what we were talking about earlier. I read the study, I never would have thought of that. And then as we unpack the mechanisms and look at the data, that makes sense to me now. And I think that that's something we should still aspire to do.
Yeah.
What do you make of all this?
I feel that we need to do a lot of thinking about the structures involved, the incentives, and just the way that the data infrastructure, in a way, the process of funding research that's going to be big enough to make any sense, the support for sharing data, and you're right, it's not just social psychology. I mean, psychology has taken the brunt of this, but talking to epidemiologists, they're worried that basically all the medical trials are too small. And they're too small because they have various very high standards, and we like high standards, but the very high standards make the trials incredibly expensive to run. And if the trials are very expensive to run, yep, you run the smallest possible trial that you could. Yep. And there are ways to patch that up. You go, well, you know, we'll do a meta-analysis, we'll put together a bunch of trials, but that's not as useful as just doing the first trial really well. And I feel, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this recently, but I feel that there are some amazing things we could be doing with the right kind of data infrastructure, the right sharing of tools, the right transparency, that could just lead scientific progress ahead in leaps and bounds. And at the moment, we're still fumbling towards that much more slowly than I would like.
I think you're spot on there. And I think one other thing we should add to the table is the questions we really care about, it's hard to track people long enough. Yeah. To know what the lasting effects are. I read a synthesis of research recently. We don't even know if dental floss is useful. Mm-hmm. Four out of five dentists tell you to floss your teeth. The empirical evidence is not conclusive.
Yeah.
I still floss my teeth, but I don't know that that's good for me.
Yeah.
And no one does.
Yeah. And we do have, there's amazing, so the National Health Service in the UK has got data on basically every interaction you've had with the healthcare system. Every time you went to the doctor, what you were prescribed, it's all there in these big data warehouses. You know, did you maybe contract a sexually transmitted infection after you got married? Interesting. Did you used to wet the bed when you were 15 years old? It's all there. And the question is how to draw. An unbelievable amount of insight can be drawn, scientific insight can be drawn out of that data. How do you do it while protecting people's privacy? And I think we know the answer. If people are nerdy enough, go and read the Ben Goldacre's review for the UK government. There are solutions to this, but they involve an investment in, I've used this phrase infrastructure before, just the way you structure the data, the way you protect the data, the rules you have, the norms you have for querying that data, which enables the science to be done openly. So every time you make a query of that data, every other scientist with permission sees what query you made. So they can, there's a bug in your code. You made a mistake. So we can fix that. At the same time, you don't ever actually get the data. You get the answer to your query. So you're protecting people's privacy while at the same time having much better structures for open science. So that's the sort of thing that we could be doing and we aren't. And yeah, it's not just about kind of cute social psychology research that is possibly not true at all. Anyway, there we go. Thank you for answering that question. I realize I got a slightly off track. I had another slightly off track question.
I don't have a track, let's be clear. We can talk about whatever you find interesting.
So well, I just wanted to get your reflections on Sheryl Sandberg, because she's just stepped down from Meta's board. This amazingly powerful businesswoman, all this influence on Facebook. She was kind of worshipped, and then Facebook fell out of fashion, and so she fell out of fashion. And I found her absolutely fascinating from a distance, but you actually wrote a book with her. So I wanted to ask you, what was that like? What did you learn working with Sheryl?
Well, actually, last time I was in the UK for Intelligence Squared, Sheryl and I did an Option B event that Malala was kind enough to host. And I think, you know, I do want to say there are huge problems in social media to fix. It has been sobering as we watch what's happened to Twitter as Elon Musk runs it, to see how much worse Facebook could be, I will say. And yes, there are many ways it could be better, and I've given a lot of input over the years. And still, I think jury is out on how we solve a lot of the problems that social media creates. I think the biggest thing that I learned from working with Sheryl is she has the highest standards of anybody I've ever met. So I was used to writing a draft and then doing a couple of revisions and seeking, you know, getting the 0 to 10 score and then revising some more based on the advice I got, and then I'm done. For Sheryl, a chapter would not see the light of day until there were at least 100 revisions. Like that was a minimum in most cases. And she was so determined to get the data right and also to be as clear as possible in her communication. And it fundamentally transformed me as a writer. And I don't know if you can see it, Tim, but when I go back and read, there's like a before working with Sheryl and there's an after working with Sheryl. Give and Take remains my favorite idea I've ever worked on. It was my first book. Oh, thank you for those of you who are familiar with it. It was the thing I'd spent.
Two people loved it.
No one else has read it. No. No, I mean, I'd chosen it as the one thing I wanted to study, and I poured a decade of my research life into it, and so it was like my baby. I would write that book so differently now, and the post-Sheryl books, Think Again and Hidden Potential, I'm much prouder of the writing, and I think they're far better books because of the way that she raised those standards for me, and I think we should all be lucky to collaborate with someone who believes enough in our potential that they're willing to say it's not done yet, even when we're ready to turn it in.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about your writing. You have this story in the book about Harvard saying, well, yeah, you can come to Harvard, but you really need help with your writing because it's bad. And you make it look very easy as a writer. You're very, very accessible. It's very easy to follow. It's definitely you. There are certain turns of phrase that only you would use, that another writer wouldn't, and that's good. There's that. It's not kind of all just smoothed off. So you're a great writer, and you were once a terrible writer, apparently. So talk us through that process.
Well, thank you. I think
did the remedial classes worked, right? But you never went to them.
No, I skipped it because I couldn't stomach the idea of taking a class that I was told was for people who spoke English as a seventh language. And heavily recruited athletes. And I got to Harvard already worrying that I was the one mistake who, you know, admissions took and I didn't belong there and I wasn't smart enough. And then they fail me on the writing test, which is the first test I take in college. My roommate.
Welcome to Harvard.
Yeah, no, but it gets worse because my roommate was the heavily recruited star quarterback on the American football team. And he passed the writing test. Like, I should drop out. I do not belong here. But one of the pieces of feedback that I got, actually, this was more advice from the writing office, was they said, you really need to work on structure because we could not follow your argument. And this is something that still is a challenge for me, which is I suffer more and more now from what psychologists call the curse of knowledge, which is when you know something, you can't imagine what it's like to not know it. And that means it's really hard to explain it to other people who don't understand it. It's why so many, like the worst physics teacher you could have for intro physics would be Einstein. Because he cannot relate to what it's like to not understand relativity. Actually, he was a terrible teacher and had to cancel his classes because he couldn't draw enough students despite his brilliance, or maybe because of his brilliance and his expertise. Anyway, So one of the things I had to learn to do was to actually explain my ideas out loud before I wrote them to somebody who knew nothing about the subject. And it's probably my most useful exercise today still.
Yeah. So what advice would you give me? I'm 10 books in. I'm working on 11th, it's hard. How can I become a better writer?
How can Tim Harford become a better writer? That's like David Beckham asking how he can become a better footballer.
I dispute the premise, but still, but...
I'd have to think more about that to do it justice, but if you want an off-the-cuff reaction...
Yeah?
I think one thing that I would love to see you do is stay with your amazing stories longer. Your story about Keith Jarrett, to this day, when I sit down to write a story or to prep a TED Talk, like the Tim Harford standard is what I'm trying to hit. And sometimes it's over too soon for me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so rich and so interesting. I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel a little bit of you and I have the same instincts, which is we love the data and the science more. And the story is just a vehicle. But as a reader, I'm less like myself and more like the audience, I think. Yeah. And I want you to go into the full narrative more than you do. And you do that beautifully on Cautionary Tales. And I think you could do more of it on the page.
Okay, noted. Thank you.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared. And to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Now you have to do it. We have a whole room full of people that are expecting it. You're accountable, Tim.
And actually, the process of writing the Cautionary Tales podcast, which is very story driven, has, I think, changed the way I think about story. I think another idea from the book that I want to do more is to get more advice earlier for more people. There are a couple of people who see everything and work over everything. But I could show the writing to more people at an earlier stage,
and try it at your own risk.
Yeah, and I don't do that because I'm scared, right? I feel uncomfortable.
And how many successful books will you have written to let go of that fear?
Yeah, well, but I feel like I don't want to show it to you before it's ready, right? But actually, it's the process of. Of course, I do, in fact, want to show it to you before it's ready, because that's why I'm showing it to you.
And that's how you get it ready.
Yeah.
I think.
And this links into you've got this lovely story about these linguists who are just unbelievably good at learning French and Italian and all kinds of obscure languages, many of whom were told...
Did you just call French and Italian obscure languages? Did anybody else hear that? I would excuse an American for doing that. You have no excuse, my friend.
It's not how it sounded in my head, but okay, I'm sure that's what I said.
And in addition, obscure languages. Yes, I'm with you.
So many of them were just told at school they were terrible at languages, or I think one of them, their father spoke Spanish at home, was a native speaker of Spanish, and they couldn't learn Spanish despite that advantage. And it turns out the secret's all about discomfort.
Yeah, I actually didn't know where this chapter was going to go, so I happened to stumble across a polyglot. This is somebody who speaks at least six languages fluently and can converse proficiently in another five. And I just think that's endlessly interesting. How did you learn to do that? Like, did you have a language gene? Were you exposed to a ton of different languages early on during a critical period? And no, it turns out that this guy, Benny Lewis, could not learn a foreign language in school and only started learning them successfully as an adult. How did that happen? And then I'm like, well, is Benny alone? And no, I find Sarah Maria Hasboon, who had the same problem and couldn't learn Spanish despite the fact that her father's Salvadorian. And she grew up in her childhood con un padre hispanohablante y todavía no puede hablar en español. So how did they learn to do that? Like, and what do they know as adult learners that we can all learn? And it turns out their core insight is really simple, which is, most of us, when we're taught languages in school, we read them and we write them. And we don't speak them yet because we don't feel comfortable. And we think we've got to master it so we don't embarrass ourselves and sound like idiots. But actually, the way to master it is to speak it. And Sarah Maria told me, she said, learning to speak a language without talking day in, day out is kind of like trying to master the piano by reading like a Schumann biography. Or trying to become a great basketball player by watching videos of Steph Curry and LeBron James. Not gonna happen. And in order to get over this hurdle that they faced, they had to not only embrace, but amplify discomfort. So Benny, he's Irish, and he sets a goal. He moves to a country, and he says, I wanna be proficient in 3 months. And his goal is to make 200 mistakes a day when he talks to you. And so he literally will memorize a script in a language he doesn't understand and walk up to strangers and introduce himself and say, hi, I'm Benny. I'm trying to learn a language and I don't speak this language. And then see how they respond. And every time he makes a mistake in a script, somebody gives him a tip. Mm-hmm. And every moment that he makes a mistake, he remembers the lesson better because he had that little pang of, oh, this is awkward. Why am I doing this? And I think the better you get at embracing that kind of discomfort, the faster you learn.
Yeah. So seek discomfort. I'm going to come back. I think there's an interesting tension or contradiction in the book. But before I ask you,
oh, good, we're going to fight about something. Waiting for this.
Fight about.
Wait a minute, Tim. Hold on a second. You won the national debate championship once upon a time.
Yeah, it was 1992.
Okay.
You were like 6 years old at the time.
I was 11.
Okay.
But I really thought that part of what I was signing up for tonight was a chance to test my debate skills against a master. And you're not challenging me enough. I mean, you're agreeing with things I say. What kind of debate champion does that?
Okay, so hold that thought. I'm gonna come to you guys. Adam clearly wants your most hostile questions.
No. I want to learn from you debating, really. And I want to have my arguments pressure tested. So what's something you disagreed with in the book?
So it's a rather than disagreement, a contradiction. So something that puzzled me. You have this really interesting, I think, compelling argument that in order to learn, you need to seek discomfort. Like these polyglots who just humiliate themselves, who are just hungry to make the maximum number of mistakes, and you build on that and explore that. A couple of chapters later in the book, you're talking about the importance of play. And play is not gamification, it's not giving yourself little scores. Play is like really having fun, just kind of messing around and just enjoying yourself. So you're telling us that in order to learn and grow, seek discomfort. And you're also telling us in order to learn and grow, like have fun, like have a great time. So does that not strike you as somewhat contradictory?
Now we're talking. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't see that as a contradiction. I see it as a tension. And you're the first person to raise it, and it bothered me while I was writing the book, and no one who read it pointed it out, and I decided it was just in my head. Mm-hmm. And now I know it isn't, and I'm mad, and I want to go fix it. I tried to write the resolution of it, and I think where I landed is there are different kinds of discomfort, and some are beneficial and some are not. The kind of discomfort I think is not beneficial is either burnout or bore out. So you do not want to push yourself to chronic emotional exhaustion, where you feel like you have nothing left to give, and you're just completely drained of your energy. You also don't want to do something that's so monotonous that you can't imagine a reason to get excited about it, and you're just pushing yourself and using up all of your self-control. What you do want, I think, is the the more manageable discomfort of social fear, of what are other people going to think of me? Can I give them this draft? Because they might judge me. They might think I'm stupid. Or they might think I'm not as smart as I was on the last book. And then I've either lost it, or I've sold out, or I'm on a decline. It's that kind of discomfort that I think helps us, the hesitation to try something new and the hesitation to put our ideas in front of other people. That's what we need to get over. But I don't want you to suffer constantly.
Okay.
Did I resolve?
Maybe.
Maybe?
Yeah. Maybe the resolution is simply that you can't be uncomfortable all the time, and you got to have some fun, right? But you can learn through fun as well.
This is the Goldilocks theory of psychology.
Yeah.
Like everything in moderation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything in moderation, including questions from me. We should have questions from you. I've got a couple of questions from the internet. Hello, I don't know where the internet is at the moment, but hello, internet. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for sending in your questions. But let's take some questions from the room. Maybe if you take your hand up. Okay. So there's this question over there. Very enthusiastic questioner over there. I see a couple of questions here as well. So.
Hi. Oh, Madonna mia. Super briefly, three advices, tricks that you would give for people that really struggle in finding self-discipline.
Okay.
I don't know, reading the newspaper. I tried every single sort of trick, not happening.
Okay, great. There was a question here as well. There was a person who had their hand up. Yep.
Hi. It's about... I guess your talk about perfectionism and your recovery from perfectionism, but then I also think of you on the treadmill trying to get better and better and better. So I wonder, how do you balance out that habit with
another contradiction? One more question. I see there's somebody here, or can we get a microphone to this person here?
It's coming to your right.
Oh, it's coming. You got microphones coming from both sides.
Yeah, up there too.
Double threat.
All right. Okay. Hi, thank you.
In a moment, sir, thank you.
Just what was an idea that was canon to your early thinking that you thought was absolutely true that now you've completely dispelled and as you think the opposite of, or perhaps vice versa?
Are you asking me to think again?
Adam
I
never
thinks
anything. Okay, so yeah. We'll have a fourth question as well. You can hold them all in your mind, I'm sure.
Okay, I'm Antonis from Indonesia. So my question is, your suggestion is like always non-intuitive. You not say like counterintuitive. It's so counterintuitive for me. When we should start to like make a progress by like have a strength of like a burden of everyday struggle, like what Kobe Bryant said, that train more, or like Michael Pepp say, yeah, train every day. It's so obvious, not like a hidden or like a thing again things. So when we need to the newness and when we need to like a strength of burden. Thank you.
All right. Okay. So we have discipline, perfectionism, we have rethinking, and then when to make a change. Where do you want to start?
Wherever you want to start.
Okay, well, let's just go in order. Discipline. I think the most useful book I've read on that is Atomic Habits by James Clear. If you haven't read it, I've heard more people say it change their ability to exercise self-control than anything else. I also really liked Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit. And so rather than giving you three random tips, I think those resources hopefully are more helpful if you don't already know them.
Do you view yourself as suffering from a self-discipline problem?
Yes, an excess of it.
Yeah. Yeah. What am I
like, it takes discipline for me not to work,
yeah.
Actually, which is a weird problem.
Okay. Maybe we talk about that in a second, but yes. So we had. What else did we have? We had the.
Okay, so we had perfectionism.
You're going to be a perfectionist, and yet there you are on the treadmill. So
yeah. So I wrote a whole chapter about recovering from perfectionism, and it turns out I'm still in recovery. I find it really challenging, but I do think there's a difference between aiming for perfect and aiming for better. And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to get more thoughtful about which goals are worth pursuing. And what I discovered on the treadmill is a lot of running is really boring. I don't like it. And if I have a goal to get a little bit better, that keeps me motivated. I like improvement. That for me is intrinsically exciting. And so I don't ever expect to hit a result I'm proud of or that could win a race, but I like the feeling of progress. And so I'm trying to anchor on that as opposed to, well, here's a mistake I made and I screwed that up and now it ruined my day because I had a bad workout. Something I used to believe that I thought was canon that I no longer think is true. Here's a really core one. This is embarrassing. You know how you can have an email signature and some people like to have quotes that are inspiring in theirs? Maybe that's just an American thing, but when I was in college, my email signature for I think all 4 years said, "I am a great believer in luck and I find that the harder I work, the more I have of it." Thomas Jefferson. And I'm embarrassed for multiple reasons. One, Thomas Jefferson never said that, it turns out. And I failed to fact check it. I just trusted Ask Jeeves at the time. Two, I think I carried around, first of all, an excessive confidence in the one-to-one relationship between effort and results. And I really underappreciated the importance of opportunity and circumstance in shaping the returns that you got on hard work. If you were lucky to have a great coach, if you were fortunate to be born with a lot of natural talent, right? Your hard work was going to lead to different kinds of results. The other thing that I guess I found myself really turning upside down is I loved that quote because I thought that hard work was a sign of virtue. I equated being a hard worker with a good person. And I guess that is the Protestant ethic. It's what Martin Luther brought. It's what Weber wrote about. I don't believe it anymore. I don't think hard work makes you a good person. I think sometimes, depending on what you're working at, working hard can make you a worse person. Because either the ends you're pursuing are harmful, or because your work ethic really undermines the way you treat other people. And so I've just abandoned my obsession with hard work altogether.
And making a change.
When to make a change. My favorite way to think about this is to say, I hear this question from my students all the time. There's the, how do I know when it's time to take on a new skill or to change jobs or to change careers or to move to new cities?
Or to quit. I actually got a question coming in from the internet on the importance of quitting. So it's a related
thing. Yes, it is. So I worry a lot about a problem that Barry Stahl has called escalation of commitment to a losing course of action. This is where you make an initial decision, it does not work out as planned, but instead of rethinking it, you double down. And you would
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. I didn't want that conversation to end. And luckily, if you're an Intelligence Squared member, it doesn't have to. The exclusive members-only part 3 of Adam and Tim's discussion is available right now for Intelligence Squared members. Head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to get all that now. Or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Thanks for listening.